Good morning, everybody. Turn your Bibles over to 2 Kings chapter 23. There we go. 2 Kings chapter 23, and starting in verse 1. I broke the mic again. Hold on. Gonna do some fixing here. It is good to see all of you, and it's a pleasure to be able to share in this time of spiritual fellowship, this joint participation that we have to worship the God of, as Paul would call him, the God of all comfort. And I know that it's not always easy to get here and to be involved in this joint participation, but I hope that as we've prayed and as we've sung together that you've been able to benefit from this and to be able to come to a better understanding of who God is and what he's done in his care for you and his faithfulness to himself. It's this resolve that God had that's not only brought us here together, but gives us an example of how to live. And we're starting this series of lessons. Actually, this is the second lesson in our series that we've titled Resolve, so that we can learn how to emulate him. Oftentimes, throughout the Old Testament especially, God will claim something and he'll make some promise and he'll say that it's either his zeal or some other term that describes this resolve, this full and single-minded intention to accomplish a thing that will cause him to keep that promise. And it's what eventually has brought you here to him today also. And so what we'll be doing is we'll be picking up on those lessons titled Resolved, and we'll work through some of these things. Let's do a little bit of review, though. We defined some terms last week. To be resolute, and that's a term that we'll use to describe ourselves as we're changing our lives to be such. It's defined as to be admirably purposeful, determined, and unwavering. And the antonyms to that, at least as Oxford's English Dictionary was concerned, was to be irresolute or to be half-hearted. And so Oxford also says that there's only two types of people. There's either people who are resolute or people who are half-hearted. And what we've done last week is we talked about the preparation and the thought process that needs to go into being resolute, because many times, especially at this time of year, people make resolutions. They say, I will be resolute to accomplish this task, but don't set themselves up to succeed in the long run. And resolution, to be resolute, requires an amount of endurance. So last week we talked about that you need to know what it is that you're building, and we started talking that this is more about, you know, I want to eat better, or maybe do some other high-minded and noble thing, but to be resolute to serve God and him only. So you need to know what it is that you need to do with your life, what it is that he's using your life to do. He's building his temple from you and all his people. We need to understand what sort of materials then bring us to those ends, what ingredients bring about an appropriate recipe for that. So we need to use the things that God has given us to build what he wants. We need to test regularly whether or not we're actually doing that thing, because it can change from day to day if we're not careful. And then finally, we need to endure. And that was one of the shorter points in that lesson and one of the most difficult. And so we're going to spend some time on that this morning, understanding what it means to have endurance in our resolution. And so while we're thinking about that and getting ready to go through this next lesson and even this next year, maybe you were sitting in the last lesson and thinking, you know, I'm just not really a resolute person, or that's not really kind of my mindset, or I wish I could be, but there's this and that and the other thing going on in my life. And I think that's true for everybody. I think there's folks that want to be resolute, and there's folks that are doing pretty well at that. But for the rest of us, it's like, man, there's all this stuff, and when that goes away, then I'll have some time or some energy or some motivation to do it. But God expects us, I think we saw last week and we'll see today, he expects all his people to be resolute. There's just sometimes too much stuff in the way to see that you and I can do what God has expected us to do. What we're going to do this morning is be looking in 2 Kings chapter 23, and we'll start in verse 1 to see an example of a person who was resolute in all his conduct as soon as it was pointed out to him what resolution needs to be and what it looks like. And so we're going to focus on this king here, King Josiah, and the reason why we're going to pick him is because, one, the passage here says that he is a standout among all the kings of Israel, who are characterized up to this point especially as being half-hearted and irresolute people, that they serve God, but only sort of, or part of the time, or in addition to other gods, and so they were double-minded people, as James would say again, unstable in all their ways. And so what I hope then is we'd get to learn from King Josiah to learn how to be stable people, but more than just that, to be single-minded, resolute people accomplishing the goals and tasks that God has assigned to us. So we'll look at him as a good example of what it means to be resolute, and we've got just a whole bunch of points that are going to come from this. But let's go ahead and give you the title of this lesson. In fact, we'll use this picture as an analogy here. If you feel like you want to, and let's say your resolution, your New Year's resolution is, I want to eat better, well, that starts in the kitchen, and it even starts with your motivation. But when you come into your kitchen and it's just a mess, you're like, yeah, it's easier to go and order out, and then your resolution is broken. That was our meme that we'd looked at last week, that guy's eating spaghetti again on January 2nd. And so if you go through your kitchen and you clean it out and you get it all ready, it becomes really a joy and something easy to cook and to prepare meals for yourself. Now, that's an analogy, kind of low-level sort of thing. But let's take this up to our entire lives and what it is that we're creating with it as God has given us breath. And so what we're going to do or talk about this morning is what it means to be resolved, in other words, to clean, to get things ready, to prepare ourselves for endurance. So focusing on this endurance and resolve, which is so much of, that's like, you know, 9/10 of what resolve is, we're going to take away those things which make the kitchen dirty, which makes our lives complicated and messy to the point where it's like, you know what, I'm just not even going to do what God wants me to do or do it with my whole heart. We looked at Deuteronomy chapter 6, and we'll reference it several times through this lesson, that God commanded his people Israel to love him with all their heart and all their soul. And I hope that sounds familiar, because Jesus says those things as well. And those will be kind of the echoing theme of this lesson and what that means. So let's go ahead and get into it. We're going to look at 2 Kings chapter 23 at King Josiah, and we've got several points that are here. Let's go ahead and start reading verses 1 through 3. We'll set up some history and some culture and get ourselves ready to see what's happening here. We'd actually talked about this a couple of weeks ago, or at least the kind of the beginning of King Josiah's reign, as it really matters, as it makes a difference in the world. He had wanted to restore God's temple just as an interest, kind of side project sort of thing. But as they started doing that, one of the priests was clearing out one of the back storerooms. And you know, every building you're in, maybe it's your work, maybe it's your church building, there's all these little rooms and cubbies, and you're like, oh, I never knew that was in there. And they clear out this one back room, and they find a book of the law, which had apparently been lost and unknown to many of the Jewish people at this time. And one of the scribes that's there is like, I found this book. That's how he says it to the king. I found this book while I was in the back, one of the back storage rooms. And so they read the book to King Josiah. He tears his clothes and he weeps, because not only does he see commands for him as a king, how he ought to be, things that he's not been doing. He's not known any better. He was 8 years old when he became king. And so he's not been doing these things, but all of Israel's not been doing these things. And he is so convicted that he brings everything out, all the people out, he gets them all together, and they have this this ceremony, for lack of a better term. Let's look at verse 1 of 2 Kings chapter 23. It says, then the king sent, and they gathered to him all the elders of Judah and of Jerusalem. The king went up to the house of the Lord, and all the men of Judah, and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem with him, and the priests and the prophets and all the people, both small and great, and he read in their hearing all the words of the book of the covenant, which was found in the house of Yahweh. And then the king stood by the pillar and made a covenant, like a promise, this agreement. He'd sign your name to it. He made this covenant before Yahweh to walk after Yahweh and to keep his commandments and his testimonies and his statutes with all his heart and all his soul, to carry out the words of this covenant that were written in this book. And all the people entered into the covenant. So they didn't have to do this. I mean, you look through the law and you see that there's things that God has expected people to do, and you could say, Josiah, just do it, and just say, hey, everybody, just do this thing and we'll call it a day. They didn't have to make an extra oath, and yet he wants to. Now, this goes to like New Year's resolutions as well, but again, let's take this beyond just kind of the, you know, I want to eat better, I want to exercise, or I want to X or Y, that this looks to your life as a servant of God, and the first thing that you need to do is get committed. Because you want to know the first way that resolutions die, the first reason that resolutions die whenever you make those at the beginning of the year, it's typically because you don't tell anybody. And you don't make some sort of concrete, visible agreement, especially with other people involved, that holds you accountable to what's going on. You can say, on December 31st, man, I need to eat better after all that pumpkin bread and stuff. And then when the next day comes and you only said that to yourself, there's really no reason, there's no consequence, there's no accountability for just going back to eating pumpkin bread. So To get committed, then, to be resolute, starts with making some sort of proclamation, some sort of confession. We talked about that in 1 John. Making it known to anybody and everybody around that this is how I will live for the rest of my life, heart and soul. Look again as you go down to verse 3. The king stands up in front of everybody. He says, here's what I'm going to do. And he expected that everybody else do it, and they did. They all heard each other enter into this covenant to serve God. Now, there's a couple of places. We're going to stay here in 2 Kings, but these are for more reading, and if you're taking notes, you can look over in Mark chapter 12, but also Deuteronomy 6, where we had read earlier. In Mark chapter 12 and verse 30, Jesus is asked by somebody, what's the greatest commandment? And Jesus says, I'll give you two. The first greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your soul, with all your strength. And strength is included here in Mark's accounting of this. And of course, Jesus is just quoting Deuteronomy chapter 6. That is the greatest commandment, to be single-mindedly resolute to serve God and God only. Now, when we come back to Josiah here in 2 Kings 23, this is what he did, that he was going to keep God's statutes. He made a promise to God in the hearing of everyone else that he's going to keep his statutes with all his heart and with all his soul. Have you ever stopped to think for a second, either Deuteronomy or Mark or a passage like this, just how difficult it is, how all-consuming it is to love God with all your mind, all your brain space, that everything that you do, you're thinking about Him and why you're doing that to please Him and to serve Him. With all your strength, your energy, your body, whatever strength you have, and maybe you're not strong, or maybe you're sick, or maybe you're the healthiest person that's ever lived, with everything you've got to give it to Him. With all your soul, with all your mind, everything about this. Have you been committed to that extent? And here's the other thing. Have you made a confession like this along these lines to other people? Do you make this known to anybody that you come in contact with? Now, I'll say this here for a second. For those of you who are sitting in here and you've been baptized, you've entered into a covenant relationship with Jesus, whether we think about it that way or not, you at that point at least made a confession that you were going to serve Christ as King of Kings, as your only Lord and Master and Savior. You made a confession to everybody sitting there. You made a confession before God. And then Paul tells Timothy and us thereby that we regularly live a life that makes a confession that we have proclaimed that we will serve God in all the ways that He can be served, everything that I possess. So if you want to be resolute and you want to start off in a way that will actually finish, that will have endurance, remember, I'm talking to you as somebody who doesn't finish a lot of projects and is not an endurance runner and is not really interested in that sort of thing, that if you're going to do this, if you're going to live the life of Christ, this requires this, and it requires an entire reworking of your entire life. But if you do that, and if you can make a promise and hold yourself accountable, and other people can hold you accountable too, and they come up to you and they say, you know, how's that diet going? That if you're reminded of this regularly, now you can start to have real endurance. And that's what we're going to talk about from here on out. I found a lot of these points from an article and some other things that I've been thinking about as well, and I thought they'd be useful for you. The first thing here that happens after this promise that Josiah makes with all of Judah and before God, we start into the next verse in verse 4. So let's go ahead and read that actually right now. It says, then the king commanded Hilkiah, the high priest, and the priests of the second order, and the doorkeepers, to bring out of the temple of Yahweh all the vessels that were made for Baal, for Asherah, for the host of heaven, and he burned them outside Jerusalem in the field of Kidron, and carried their ashes to Beth-El. And there's a lot of things going on here. Here's the application we're going to make secondarily for us, is that he comes through his reign, his dominion, everything over which he looks and oversees and holds accountable. And so for your life, you know, we say, like, we're the masters of our household or our life or whatever. There's a lot of things that are under your purview. And the first thing that he does here after making this promise, being committed, is he gets rid of everything that causes a problem. Now, let's look through some of these details here in verse 4. He commands all the priests. He gets some help to do this. They go into the temple, and you realize what else is here in the temple? Whenever I read about the temple in the Old Testament, I typically think that, oh, no, that's God's place. And yeah, the Israelites and the Judahites are getting messed up and all this other stuff in the high places. And I forget that they've got idols in this temple. And so they go through and they get rid of all the stuff for the Baals, for the Asherahs. There's like totem poles, sort of. You'll see it regularly, these posts for Asherah that are in the temple as well. It says they had an idol for everything in the host of heaven. So you think of the Areopagus where Paul went in Acts 17, and they've got, you know, they got gods for the sun and for the moon and gods for all, you know, messengers for the gods and all these different things. They had this here in God's temple. And so they take all of that stuff out, and they take it outside of Jerusalem to a valley outside there, which we'll talk about here again in a little bit. It's typically kind of the trash heap. It's the landfill for Israel outside of Jerusalem. And they take it out there, and they burn it. Now, the lesson for us here is, if you're going to have endurance and be committed, and maybe you're looking at your life and you say, you know what, it's hard to have endurance. And yeah, it is. And, you know, I don't know if I can stick with this all the time or to 100% degree. But if that's what's happening, and if you're going to have any sort of endurance, it's because, and why you're saying this in your mind, is because there's a lot of other stuff in the way that distracts us and makes us think, you know what, I'll save that for later, or it takes up my time or my energy or whatever. Here's an even more closer to us type of example in Acts chapter 19 and verse 19. And again, you can turn there if you like, but what's going on here is this: Paul's in Ephesus and he's been preaching, and incidentally some people here and in some other towns have been calling him a messenger of the gods, which is kind of funny, and he's, I mean, kind of funny looking back in hindsight, but it freaked him out, and he stopped everybody and said, no, we're not Hermes, no, we're not Zeus, we preach Christ. And as they were making conversions and other people were getting committed and dedicating themselves to God and making a confession that they would serve Christ as king, there in Acts 19:19, there were a lot of people who were sorcerers and magicians and soothsayers and illusionists in town, and they took all of their stuff that was done, that was being used for their work, all their books for witchcraft and sorceries that you'll see there, and they all take it out in the town square and they light it on fire. And it says that the value of all those things was several thousand shekels worth of silver. This is like, for those of you who work a trade and you got your truck filled with all your tools, you just drove your truck off a cliff. And for those of you, maybe you're a lawyer, you work in a lawyer's office, and there's just all those law books that are there, and you know how much each one of those costs. You just take those all out and you burn them. That all of these things that were for your livelihood, they destroy them in the most irrevocable way possible. There's nothing that you will get back from that. Now, if you want to ask, am I going to be a resolute person? Am I going to have endurance? Would it take you to this point where you just trash your livelihood to keep that promise? You know how many times you've heard, and maybe you've said, and you know people who have said, you know, hey, I'd like to do this, or I'd like to be involved more, but, you know, I got this work thing going on, or I just can't, you know, change my schedule, and all this different stuff. Is that causing so much of a problem where, at the end of your life, wherever that might be, tomorrow or a few years from now or decades, that you won't have been able to do enough because your job stood in the way? I mean, if you put it that way, it starts to seem like such a smaller thing. But right now, tomorrow, you got Monday and work's coming up. It, like, job is looming over your mind. But here Josiah got rid of everything. The people in Acts 19 got rid of everything. How much would we get rid of so that we could be resolute people? Let's go back to 2 Kings 23 and see another example here. Verse 5. And we'll read verse 5, and then we're going to pick up again in verses 15 through 20 just to show the extent to which he takes verse 5. It says here that he did away with the idolatrous priests whom the kings of Judah had appointed to burn incense in the high places, of which, from verse 4, Bethel is one of those. They've hijacked that to be a high place, you know, worshiping their gods on the mountaintop sort of thing. It says that he got all these priests here that burn incense in the high places in the cities of Judah and the surrounding area of Jerusalem. Also those who burn incense to Baal, remember, who are doing that in the temple, because there's idols for them in the temple. Says to the sun and the moon, so that's the host of heaven, to the constellations and all the host of heaven. And he brought, let's skip ahead now. We'll look at verse 6 in a second. Well, let's go down to verse 15. So he takes these priests and he gets rid of them. And you might say, like, to what extent do you get rid of them? If you've ever seen, you know, old-timey gangster movies or whatever, it's like, we'll get rid of them. It's that kind of getting rid of these priests. And so they take them out here, and in verse 15 it says, furthermore, the altar that was at Bethel and the high place which Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel sin, had made, even that altar, which had started all these problems, and it says, in the high place he broke down, then he demolished its stones, ground them to dust, burned the Asherah. Now, when Josiah turned, he saw the graves that were there on the mountain, and he sent and took the bones from the graves and burned them on the altars and defiled it, and according to the word of Yahweh, which the man of God proclaimed, who proclaimed these things. Then he said, "What is this monument that I see?" And the men of the city told him, "It's a grave of the city of the man of, or rather, it's a grave of the man of God who came from Judah and proclaimed these things, which you have done against the altar of Bethel." He said, "Let him alone. Let no one disturb his bones." So they left his bones undisturbed with the bones of the prophet who came from Samaria. Josiah also removed all the houses of the high places which were in the city of Samaria, and the kings of Israel had made provoking Yahweh, and he did to them just as he had done in Bethel. All the priests of the high places who were there he slaughtered on the altars, on their own altars, and burned human bones on them. And then he returned to Jerusalem. Can you imagine, like, to what extent this looks like? And it sounds like Josiah has personally arrived to all these places to make sure that it's done. He's not given this or outsourced this to anybody else. And so he's come in here, and he's not just pushed people out of town, like, "Don't come back here, you hear," or anything like that. He has had them executed, as God's prophet had told must happen. And then he didn't just bury them or just, like, throw them in a ditch or anything like that. He took all their bones and all their remains, and he burned them on the altars that they had used to worship their false gods. This is, you might say, barbaric. But from Josiah's point of view, and I believe from God's also, he was committed to go all the way with this. Now, I'm not saying that you go out and you start getting rid of people in your life. But if you look at 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 33, the passage there is very simple. And again, if you think, "Oh, man, it's really hard to endure, and, you know, like, I got to go see my friends, or I got to go to work again, or I got to see my family, or different things like that," and that is a barrier to being resolved to serve God, the Proverbs say this, the Psalmist says this, Paul says in 1 Corinthians that bad company corrupts good morals. You think, okay, today, you know, tomorrow or next week, I'll be more resolved. I'm just going to go see my friends this time. That's not going to happen. I'll just tell you right now, it's guaranteed. Your life will start to take an entirely different trajectory with that kind of social scenery going on. And so when Josiah thought about this, he thought, "We got to get rid of all these other people that are teaching and influencing my people, God's people, away from serving him." Now, think about this for a second. Maybe this is something you're thinking about too. But what about evangelism? I need to have my friends. I need to have people around me so that I can talk to them about the gospel. Well, there's something that's going on there. If your friends need the gospel, which everybody needs the gospel, but we don't live like an influence around them, so they need the gospel, and that's why I need these friendships. If we've not mentioned the gospel to them, we're not influencing them in any other way. They're influencing us. If we aren't resolute people, single-minded people, they will be an influence on us. That is to say, if we are not an influence, what's happening there? There's always some sort of give and take, some push and pull in all of our relationships, sometimes for good, sometimes for ill. But the people who are resolute, the people who have made a commitment, will, by nature of their existence in their circles, in their work, in their friends, all these different things, they will change the social makeup. You cannot be a resolute Christian in among other people who are not Christians, and you just co-equally, constantly exist together that same way in those same friendships forever. Something's got to give. Either they convert, or you do. I read a study a couple years ago about how there's lots of missionaries going over to Africa and different places like that, and the vast majority of younger missionaries, so college age, thinking, "I'm going to go help out my church or whatever, I'm going to go preach the gospel to people in these other places," came back converted to whatever other sort of religion was going on there in Africa. The vast majority is that the influence moves one way or another, and if you are not resolute, you will be changed by your social makeup, or you will change it if you are resolute. Josiah did so, and is a great example of such. Let's go back to 2 Kings 23 and start in verse 7 through 10. We'll continue the main narrative here in verse 7. So he gets rid of the stuff that's in God's temple, the place where God is worshipped, which is to say, what about our lives, where God dwells among us? And then in verse 5, he gets rid of the people, the influences which turn his people away, which turns God's people away. And then next, in verse 7, he gets rid of the places where sin happens. We saw a little bit of it already, but let's look at it here again in verse 7. It says, he broke down the houses, so the dwelling places, of the male cult prostitutes, which were in the house of Yahweh, where the women were weaving hangings for the Asherah. If you think about what the temple looks like, what Solomon's temple looks like, there's the main kind of building place where there's the holy place and then the most holy place in the back. Off of that are some wings where there are those storerooms that we read about where the book of the law was just kind of stuffed away back in there. But then in front of the main temple building, still considered a part of the temple, is the courtyard. And you've got these walls that go around it, and you've probably seen some diagrams that try and describe what the Bible gives out as kind of a blueprint that's there. And it's a large place where people in Jesus' time were buying and selling, and he drives out the money changers out of the courtyard. You could allow certain people, certain Gentiles later on to enter the courtyard, but no closer than that. And so you'd imagine here this temple grounds to come in to worship God or to offer your sacrifice for atonement for your sins. If you were at this time a resolute and faithful follower of God, that you have to walk by prostitutes. You have to walk by all this other stuff that's going on, these totem poles and these hangings for these other gods and all this artwork that's going on there, all this stuff you've got to walk by to get to where God should be worshipped. And do you think then that God would still be happy with all that stuff going on? Do you think that you, after a while, you might even make it to that altar where God is served? So Josiah comes in and he burns all this stuff. He gets rid of all of it. And again, you can read in the next couple of passages down to verse 15 and 20 again that he defiles all these altars. He burns the high places. He gets rid of everything that's going on. And so our application for us then takes a little look like Proverbs chapter 5 and verses 7 through 14, or even closer to home. In Proverbs 5, Solomon, the author of the Proverbs, at least his thought here, is talking to his son or his sons or just any reader that will come to Proverbs. And he's talking about this woman that's walking by the street. And he says, I noticed her from my window, and that she calls people to her house. And she says, my husband's away. Just come with me. We'll have our fill of love, she tells them. And he says that she leads them away like a little lamb to their death. And so then he tells his son in verses 7 through 14, do not dare go to her doorway. Do not go to her house, because if you do, your strength will be sapped from you. Your honor will be impeached. Other people will lay in wait for you and take your life. You will be changed to take the lives of others. Do not dare go to that place. You might say, well, it's just a building. It's just a door. But we know there's more than that. When we talk about Josiah getting rid of these places, or the author of the Proverbs getting rid of these places, this can look very real to us as well in an application. There are places where you and I might go to be involved in some sin that we've been involved in. And you can think of, you know, like obvious places, right? Like there's a brothel there, but there's other places too. There's other places in your own home that wait for you, that are maybe secretive enough, or that you can go to a place somewhere else without telling anybody, to do the things that we've done before we came to Christ and maybe still continue after that. Maybe it's a computer turned away so that the only way that it can be seen is by you and not somebody coming in the door. Maybe it's the music that's waiting in your car for when you leave here this morning. Maybe it's your phone and some of the notifications that come up for that. There's all sorts of places which are waiting to take you away to your grave. And then we find ourselves surprised when we say, you know what, it's hard to be resolute. It's like there's a lot of time that's needed for that. There's a lot of energy that's needed for that, a lot of mind space that's needed for that. It's true. But we've got all this other stuff that's in the way. I was reading this book last year titled Digital Minimalism. And the idea was, it was a secular book. It had no spiritual applications. But I thought it interesting that the point that he makes is, well, we got our phones and different things like that, and it's just taking away our time for stuff. But we justify it because we can get some sort of minor benefit from that. And you're going to see this here in Josiah. I mean, obviously not with a phone or anything. But you'll see it in our lives too. Let's look over at verse 11 here. We'll skip a few verses after where we've just read. Chapter 23, and starting in verse 11. It says, he did away with the horses which the king of Judah had given to the son at the entrance of the house of Yahweh, so the temple, by the chamber of Nathan-Melech, the official, which was in the precincts, and he burned the chariots of the sun with fire. If you do a little bit of history from how Israel gets these horses and these chariots, they typically go and buy them from Egypt. Egypt has a military-industrial complex, and they can sell to the highest bidder. And so when you needed to go to war with somebody, just about everybody would go down to Egypt, buy a whole bunch of chariots off their used chariots lot, and bring them back home to do war. And here at this time, some people had bought these chariots, which God had commanded for them never to go back to Egypt. I pulled you out of there once. I'm not going to do that again. Do not go back there. And they had these chariots, and even with these horses and these chariots, they decided to dedicate some to the sun. And you can imagine if some of those were brought out to battle, that this would be like the battalion of the sun, and that this would be a reference to some god that they had worshipped. Just like, oh yeah, there are those guys who serve God and whatever, and those guys that serve the Baals, and we've got all our battalions here ready to go. And you might think, well, hey, if we're going to go to war, we need to win this thing so that, we can serve God better. And so we need as many horses and chariots as we can get. But Josiah's confidence in God to win all his battles for him caused him to go burn down the things that might have allowed him to survive in physical combat. Except there was greater dangers there. There were greater dangers than having the small, minor benefits of a few extra cavalry members that might be able to do something one way or another. So what does this look like for us? Let's turn to this passage here in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 29. We talked about examples of maybe it's your phone is an example that causes you to be irresolute, that is that place where you sin, it's this items or whatever, you know, just fill in the blank, whatever it is that causes difficulties for you. And so I'm not picking on a phone just because phones and I'm a Luddite or anything like that. It's just that there's dangers where we don't think they will be. And in Matthew chapter 5, so I use the phone as an example because I think most everybody does. And smartphones are pretty cool. You can do a lot of things on that. I got a calendar on that. I got my emails on that. I can be in contact with most of you on that. And I say, hey, that's a good thing. But let's say that my phone is what's causing me problems. And my phone is what's taking away my time. And my phone is where I sin. And my phone is all these things. Well, then as much of a benefit as it is to, let's say, talk to you, to have a conversation with you, I can find that benefit in other ways. I can actually, like, show up at your house, and we can actually have a real conversation. But if I think, no, I need this thing in my life because it provides this good thing, that we're setting ourselves up for failure. You might think, hey, my hand's got a lot of benefit. I mean, it's how we build stuff. It's how we become the civilization that we've become. But Jesus says, hey, your hand has a lot of benefit, but if it's causing a problem, you know what he says to do. He says to cut it off. And I don't think Jesus is just like using an analogy or just trying to shock them into, you know, hey, pay attention to this. I think Jesus is as serious gets for this. Let's read the passage in verse 29. And I read this not thinking like, oh, this is an easy one. Let's just throw this out there. This is super scary stuff. In verse 29, he says, if your right eye causes you or makes you stumble. So let's take this to the lessons case. If it causes you to say, you know, I just don't have enough time. Or I can't be resolute because of this or that. If your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you. For it is better for you to lose one of your parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown in hell. If your right eye makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. Or rather, your right hand, makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. For it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. You know some other places as well, the other Gospels that reference this, that say that what would it benefit a man if he gains the whole world? And you gain all the benefits, but you lose your soul. Is it worth it? And so Josiah and Jesus commands us, and all the way to our lives, we've got things in our lives, everybody does, where there's some good that could be derived from it if we think about it. But we got to be really careful to think, is this a self-justification where I can say, no, I can have this thing, this place or this person or this object in my life that causes me to sin, that causes me to stumble, because I get, you know, I get my calendar events organized and that's useful for me. So Josiah gets rid of the stuff. He gets rid of the people. He gets rid of the places. He gets rid of the minor benefits that might give him something, an edge in combat. And he goes then from here back to 2 Kings chapter 23, and he removes any sort of way to get back. Let's go back to 2 Kings chapter 23, and let's start reading in verse 12. It says here that all the altars that were on the roof, the upper chamber of Ahaz, which the kings of Judah had made, and the altars which Manasseh had made in the two courts of the house of Yahweh, the king broke down, and he smashed them there, and he threw their dust into the brook Kidron. And I imagine as he's standing there, because it sounds like he's very personally involved and present when all this stuff happens, he's not going to make the same mistakes as the previous kings. I imagine they throw the dust here in the river, and they just watch it go away. And you're never going to find that stuff again. You're never going to be able to use that, wet it down, make some mortar for some bricks for a new altar and say it's like a reincarnation of the previous. There's no way you're ever going to find that again. See you later. You've heard of examples from history of Cortez burning his ships so that nobody could go back. That if we're going to be resolute and have endurance, you have to remove all these other things that we talked about, but you have to close off the way back, the door back, because if it's there, you'll take it at some point. When it gets just a little bit too hard or a little bit easier to do that, you'll take it. And it will seem so easy and it will seem justifiable by that. Let's go over to Hebrews chapter 11. It's my favorite passage that talks about getting rid of the way back. And since we're living our lives by faith, as we've been talking about, to be resolved by faith, the Hebrew author speaks to resolve and endurance in faith. And that also means not looking back to the beginning of things. In verse 13, he's just given a list of several people, Abel and Noah and Abraham and Moses. And in verse 13, it says that all these died in faith without receiving the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance and having confessed. So they made a promise that they were strangers and exiles in the earth. In other words, this world is not my home. For those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking a country of their own. And indeed, if they had been thinking of that country from which they went out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. You know, what's kind of interesting here is that the Hebrew author uses the word patrides, which is where we get our word patriot. And then he says these people are real patriots in that they forgot all about their earthly country. They gave it up. Whatever parties are going on there, whatever, you know, political parties and conflicts between people, they gave those things up. And they told people all the time, they made a confession, like we talked about in class, that I'm not here anymore. This is not my country anymore. I am of a new place. I am of a heavenly country. I've renounced my citizenship. I can't go back. And as you make that confession to other people, you let other people know, believers and non-believers alike, that there is no way. You cannot endure any longer. You will continue on in your resolve to serve God. And so notice how God looks at that kind of person, the person who's gone to those extremes. It says there, therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he's prepared a city for them. When you do this stuff in your life, whatever shape it looks like, and everybody's struggles are different, the stumbling blocks are different for every person, there might not be two people in this room that have the same exact sort of issue, but the people who have gone to the extremes to get rid of that, who have maybe lost family members and other relationships because of that, who've lost things that were terribly expensive to them, who've lost ways of life, vocations and jobs, who've lost all these things because those were causing problems in resolution, God says, I got a home for you, I got a place for you, and you'll always be home here. The resolute, the patriot, is always home in his city. So they get rid of the way back. But here's the last point of the lesson. Here's where we'll bring this up. Is that you don't just clean your house and leave it the way that it is. Jesus actually has a parable very much like that. In that if you clean your house, now you're just this empty person. And you got no personality, and you got no interests, and you got no hobbies, and everybody thinks that you're boring, and because you're just pressing on to something, like, what is that thing? And that can look very interesting to people in some ways. It can look like an oddity. But you don't leave the house just clean. You don't clean out the kitchen and not cook in it. You now get to the work. But here's where the work gets so much easier. If you've ever thought, it is so hard to be resolute, and maybe you've thought, it is impossible to serve God with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength. If that's an impossibility at the beginning, well, if you've done these things, replacing it with what's better is the easiest thing you could do. It's the simplest thing that you could do. There's no other option for anything else that you could do. It's just what has to happen. Let's look over in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. We'll turn here. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, and chapter 5 and verses 6 through 8. 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verses 6 through 8. Paul's talking about several different things going on here. He's going to lead into the Lord's Supper here in a little bit. He's talking about some sin that is being committed by one of the individuals in the congregation. The whole congregation has committed sin by just going along with it. But just to life in general as well, we'll take this comment in verse 6. He says, your boasting is not good. That is, just they're just letting sin go on. You know, just like, hey, we're not resolved to do that now. It's difficult now. We're going to hurt that relationship now, whatever it might be. He says, your boasting is not good. Do you not know the little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough? He says, clean out the old leaven so that you may be a new lump, just as you are in fact unleavened. That's how Christ made you now as a new creation in him. He says, for Christ our Passover also has been sacrificed. Therefore, let us celebrate the feast, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. Being sincere, that is, to the word that he used there is the opposite of hypocrites, which is like an actor wearing a mask. That's the connotation that comes from that. To be a sincere, open, single-minded, this is who I always am. I'm not wearing a mask tomorrow or anything like that. To be that kind of person means to get rid of whatever leaven is going on in your life, whatever thing is distracting, is taking away time, is taking away energy and mind space, to replace them with this one thing that's better, the service of Christ. You can look at other passages, too, if you want to read some more about this. We don't have time this morning to look at all these details, but Philippians chapter 4, 2 Peter chapter 1, all these passages that talk about, here's what you add to your faith, here's what you dwell on, here's what you think about. And it's not going to be anything like you used to think about. And you're not going to like the same music anymore. And you're not going to use your technology the same way anymore. And you're not going to go to the same places anymore. And that is perfectly fine. You're a new creation in Christ. I want to go back one more time to 2 Kings chapter 23 and read the last verse in this passage that describes King Josiah. Some might say, rampage, you're crazy, you're extreme, you're idealistic, whatever. God looks at him a different way. 2 Kings chapter 23. And let's look at verse 25. It says here, in fact, actually, let's go up to 21. This will connect 1 Corinthians. It says, then, after all that stuff, then the king commanded all the people, saying, celebrate the Passover to Yahweh your God, as it is written in the book of the covenant. Surely such a Passover has not been celebrated from the days of the judges who judged Israel, nor in all the days of the kings of Israel and of the kings of Judah, but in the 18th year of King Josiah, this Passover was observed to Yahweh in Jerusalem. Moreover, Josiah removed the mediums and the spiritists and the teraphim and the idols and all the abominations that had been in the land of Judah and in Jerusalem, that he might confirm the words of the law, and that he might keep his promise also. It says here, which were written in the book that Hilkiah the priest found in the house of Yahweh. Now look at this. Before him there was no king like him, who turned to the Lord with all his heart, and with all his soul, and with all his might, according to all the law of Moses, nor did any like him arise after him. The scripture says this is a rare kind of person. It's a rare person that will go to those lengths to serve God. But it's a person who has a home with him, even though he's burned down all of his home as he knows it to this point. Will we be those kind of people? And, you know, obviously, I hope the point has come across that we can't just, like, immediately go, yeah, I will. Like, just it's just going to happen. It's just a knee-jerk reaction to this. It says there is no earthly king like Josiah before or after him. He cleaned his house. He prepared his way for success. He was resolute. And he endures. This is exactly what Jesus calls us to do. To love the Lord our God with all our heart, with all our soul, with all our mind, and with all our strength. I'd like you to think about this during the week. Take some time in the evenings, at least when you get back from your work. Make time for it. Be resolute in that. To ask yourself, will I be that kind of person? Will I be like Josiah? Will I love my God this way? If you'd like to make that commitment, you can do so this morning. and you can confess before everybody here that you've given your life over to Christ, and you can enter into a relationship with Him through baptism, this symbol of a removal of your life, a drowning of your old self, so that you can be resurrected into a new existence which Christ gives you, an existence which only serves Him. And if you'd like to do that this morning, let us know. If you'd like to study about it, let us know. Let's stand and sing together.